900 AM.
The administration has established a new information sharing environment office to discover, protect, fuse, and reuse data across five core communities: intelligence, defense, foreign affairs, law enforcement, and homeland security. Shmendra Paul has been tasked as ISE lead to increase government-wide data sharing efficiencies through the use of standards and information technology. Join FCA Bethesda, Paul, and ISE partners for a discussion on the topic March 16th at the Bethesda North Marriott. To register, visit fciabethesda.com/marbreakfast.
Newsmakers on the Federal Drive.
Stuart Bowen is Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction. As the State Department employees begin to head to Iraq, what's their first order of business when they take over?
The most important piece that they are inheriting from the Department of Defense is the security piece, the police development program. For stability to be sustained in Iraq, rule of law has to succeed, and a crucial piece of the rule of law program is a good police force.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/federaldrive.
This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
For Your Benefit, we're here this morning to talk about federal employee accountability, changes in the rules, problem employees, star employees, and you get into pay.
Pay issues, and here, and just it's just Bill and I, and it's Bill Bransford, senior partner, Sean Bransford, managing partner.
That's right, Bob.
Okay,
yes, that's right.
I don't want to mess up.
It's good to be here.
Good morning, Bill. Well, it's great to have you. It's been about a year, and as I remember, our discussions are always lively. It's like a tennis match. You always win. But anyway, what are federal accountability rules? And I'm an accountant, so I think in GAO.
Well, it means when you are not doing your job, somebody holds you accountable. And, you know, you think, well, that should always happen. But there is a greater emphasis on that now, particularly with the Republicans in the House of Representatives. There is a greater emphasis on this. And it appears that there may be some changes in the rules, or at least the emphasis.
Are they going to drill down further? Or are they going to look at what somebody produces in a day? Or the quantity?
Well, I think what they're going to do is they're going to try to encourage managers, federal employee managers, to do that. And right now, quite frankly, a lot of managers are doing that. But there's a public perception that problem employees aren't being dealt with. Poor performers are being allowed to flourish. Bringing others down to a lower level. And so I think there's going to be some debate, some rhetoric, some tinkering around the edges to try to create with the public that the House of Representatives, the current leadership in the House of Representatives, is trying to do something to make federal employees more accountable than they already are. There is, quite frankly, a perfectly good accountability system in place for federal employees. To the extent it doesn't work because either managers aren't trained or there is a lack of will by the leadership in an agency to make it work.
Right. And I should say, when you listen to Bill, you're listening to the voice of experience, the be-all, end-all in D.C.
I don't know if that sounds good, Bob.
We're probably the same age. You're probably younger, but probably a lot smarter. But anyway, you have had many years doing this, correct? How many years you've been at this?
Well, I did it for the government for a while, and I've been with the law firm where I work since 1983, so that's a long time.
Yeah, I think I remember meeting you in the early 80s. We had lunch with Jerry Shaw. Yeah, I remember it well. Army Navy Club. Anyway, so the federal accountability rules. If I'm a manager, I'm going to switch this around, manager to staff member. But if I'm a manager, how do I encourage people to not run afoul of these laws and not be accused of being a dictator.
Well, it's an interesting point, because somebody who is a manager who's a bit too tough on his or her employees will come under management review, or they'll call in a team to do a workplace climate assessment, and all of a sudden the manager is under the gun. The manager becomes the one who's being held accountable, perhaps because they have done too much to deal with their employees. And sometimes some managers are rather unfairly targeted by subordinate employees who misuse or use, sometimes they use it appropriately, but sometimes they misuse the EEO system to file EEO complaints, to kind of pile on the manager. And then higher level managers, perhaps sometimes the political leadership, says, "Oh my gosh, what's going on with that rogue manager down there? We better supervise. We better, you know, see what's going on. Do this assessment, and then take some kind of an action." And that has an effect with other managers of, "Oh my gosh, I shouldn't do anything. Be, you know, tough to my employees. I shouldn't hold them accountable, because then the same thing will happen to me." So what I'm sensing is a desire by Congress to take a look at that, to try to create systems and where managers are encouraged to take reasonable action. But quite frankly, the real problem is that managers need to be trained, and Congress is not willing to pass legislation to train managers, because the Congressional Budget Office says there's a price tag. And right now, there isn't anything going through Congress that costs money. So, you know, and yet you have this public perception that there's a lack of accountability, which could be taken care of with managerial training. And that would cut down on EEO complaints, MSPB appeals, arbitrations, all of which, in fact, cost money for an agency to respond to them. So there's a looking at this by the Congressional Budget Office like, well, it costs money to train the managers, to send them to training classes, but they don't really look at the savings that are result from making good personnel decisions, keeping employee grievances down, and this mechanism, this system that's in place to respond to those employee grievances and appeals. So I look at it, what's going on as well, there's a lot of talk and a lot of rhetoric, but if you're not willing to spend the money to create a good system, with rules where managers aren't under the gun when employees file EEO complaints, where managers have some ability to protect themselves, to be a part of that process, to have a lawyer when that employee files an EEO complaint against them, to know what the employee is complaining about so that they can intelligently respond to it. Those sorts of things don't necessarily exist now, and so you have. You have a situation where a manager might do the right thing in holding an employee accountable, and then all of a sudden the manager, because of this complicated system, becomes the target. So there is, I think, going to be a look at, can the system be made simpler? Can probationary periods be extended? Can we do something so that managers are properly trained, so that they do it right when they take an action, when they hold somebody accountable? All of those things, I think, are being looked at. But then when you get into, do we really want to put this in place because it costs money, I think there's a reluctance.
All right. Now, for those of you all listening, this is live. It's 10:14 a.m. It's March 14th, 2011. We will run to 10:57 and a half. And please, give us a call. You have a unique opportunity to talk to an attorney that knows, I would say, close to it all. 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. And that attorney, of course, is Bill Bransford, senior partner, manager, Shaw Bransford. Anyway, Bill, let's get back to this. Could I ask you another question? I just have to, you know, play devil's advocate here a little bit. Let's say that I'm the new kid on the block and I'm placed in a managerial position, or I've worked my way up and they've made me a manager, but maybe I don't have the training to be a manager. What do I do? I look at this accountability standards and I go to the staff and I say, okay, new sheriff's in town and this is what we're going to do. But how does somebody like that approach them so that they don't get turned upon.
Well, you know, that's a really interesting point, Bob, because when you are working, as you said, work your way up, and we'll use, as we were talking before the show, the revenue officer at the Internal Revenue Service who's out there auditing you know, tax returns and whatnot, works him or herself up because they do a really good job. And they're very thorough, and they're very precise, and they usually get the rules right, and they apply them to all of those tax returns and taxpayers audits that they do, and they do a good job. And so you get to the point where you want to promote them to the next level, but it turns out they're already at the top of their pay scale. So the only way to promote them and give them more money is to promote them into a supervisory system. That's the way the government works, pretty much. And most higher level managers who are making hiring decisions says, well, John's been a really good technician. Let's reward him. We'll make him a manager. And then they don't necessarily do a couple of things. One is they don't really look at what's John's aptitude to be a manager? How good are his people skills, his interpersonal relationships? How good is he at actually, you know, maybe he's good at holding taxpayers accountable if he's a revenue officer, but how good is he at holding employees accountable on a day-to-day basis? And there's a couple ways that could be done. I mean, you know, you can put people on special assignments, give them a task force, have them be an acting manager when at times and really assess how good of a job they do. But I'm not so sure that there's a mechanism in most agencies to really kind of try to figure out who has managerial skills and who might succeed, who might not, just simply be able to succeed at that. And then the second thing is the training. You know, they come in and, you know, they might never get training. It's haphazard, and there's some agencies that do a great job of training. Last year at the Department of Defense, the Defense Authorization Act requires DOD to train all of its managers. So at DOD, at least a significant part of the workforce does have managerial training, and yet, you know, it's up and running. It's getting started. It isn't in effect yet. You know, you're talking about a several-year program to really implement it. It will be done, but it's a slow process, and who knows whether the next Defense Authorization Act will simply take that away, like they did the NSPS pay system, and you know, it's again a way to save money, because that seems to be what Congress cares about most right now. How many programs can we cut, and how good can we look to our constituents that we've saved a lot of money?
In your experience, when you look at somebody in a management position, the manager wants to do a better job by having the staff do a better job, but how do they get people to rally around them? I mean, you can't take them to lunch, maybe like you can in a private industry.
You can't
go play golf.
You certainly can't. Well, you can take them to lunch, just can't pick up the check.
Yeah, and so how do you get this spirit of cohesiveness? And more importantly, what about the one or two people in the group that think they should be sitting in the manager's seat? In your experience, have you found somebody like that to bring action against the manager? Yeah. Because it should have been my job?
Oh, well, certainly. Absolutely, that does happen. And not only should have been my job you know, taking action against the manager, but also, you know, a lot of passive resistance, making it difficult for the manager. That does happen. But a couple of things that I tell managers to do. So first thing, the very first thing is to, you know, really be fair and objective about the work that your subordinates are doing. Be connected. Talk to them. See what it is they do. And when you sense a problem, either because of poor performance, lack of productivity, failure to come to work, being a problem and getting along with other people, never being at their desk when they're supposed to be, yelling at coworkers, upsetting their fellow coworkers and customers who may call in on the telephone or come visit the office. Any of those things that, as they happen, a lot of us are conflict avoidant, and we'll see those things happen, and we just sort of, oh, he didn't really mean to do that. And so we avoid it and we ignore it. So the number one thing I tell managers is don't procrastinate. You know, when you have a problem, you deal with it. You deal with it right away. And the second thing that I talk to managers about is as you have problems, you document them. You know, for example, you know, documentation today with computers is so easy. It's so easy to simply write yourself an email, put it in a password protected file, and keep it there until you need it. It's so easy as you make changes to a subordinate's work product and using track changes to simply keep a copy of the track changes and put some comments in there about what an awful piece of work this was that you produced. You know, I expect a lot better of you next time, and put that in there, and you save the document with the track changes and the comments. And so this documentation, so don't procrastinate and document are the kind of the two underpinnings that managers should take to have credibility with their workforce and to overcome this attack that will come from the employee through the EO system. And then also to kind of prove to their higher level managers that, hey, you know, I'm really doing this right. I'm doing the right thing. This is a problem employee. I'm a good manager. And the other thing they want to do is make sure that the employee relations office and HR is aware of what they're dealing with, so that they get the support from some of these people in the agency whose job it is to help and assist the manager. So that's kind of the underpinning. But then you've got to do a couple of other things too. You can't discriminate. You can't play favorites. You have to treat everybody the same. Now, that doesn't mean you have to treat them 100% the same, because if you've got a good worker and a bad worker, you can actually distinguish between them based upon that reason. But you don't distinguish because you like somebody and you take them out, you know, and you play golf on the weekends and they're your buddy, or you go to lunch with them all the time. You don't play favorites that way, and then it increases your credibility with the agency. You also avoid making snap judgments and making decisions without necessarily having your act together. Make sure you have all the information, and then make a decision that might affect your subordinate employees. And they can tell. You know, most of the people that work for the federal government actually are very bright, perceptive people, and they can tell when a supervisor is not being thorough, when they're discriminating, when they're retaliating, when they're playing favorites. And they can tell when they're not really documenting, and they're not really doing the basic work that they have to do. And they can especially tell when the supervisor procrastinates and puts off dealing with a problem situation. In fact, most people that experience that feel like, well, I'm not really doing anything wrong, because if I was, my supervisor would tell me. Therefore, what I'm doing must be perfectly okay. So those are some of the things. And you know what's interesting is, because I started off by saying we have this perfectly good accountability system for federal employees and dealing with federal employees. And if a manager simply did those things that I said, they would be able to use that currently existing accountability system with a great deal of confidence that they would be successful. So that's what I think a successful manager would do. And yet you've got this system that doesn't necessarily train managers to do those things I said, doesn't help them understand how this system works, doesn't help them understand what an EEO complaint is and how much vulnerability a manager has or does not have because an EEO complaint has been filed, or, you know, what whistleblower retaliation is, and when are you retaliating against a whistleblower, and when are you simply dealing with a problem employee. You know, managers don't know, and so therefore, you know, all of this builds into the desire to procrastinate, because then you avoid this legal morass that sometimes a manager doesn't understand because they haven't been trained. So it's complicated. And what we're seeing now on the Hill is this desire to greater accountability. And, you know, it all stems from, you know, easier to understand, a lot of publicity about what's going on in Wisconsin, you know, the end of collective bargaining. And if you drill down on that, what you find out is that some of the Republicans who've supported this elimination of collective bargaining have talked about, well, once you get tenure, you can't fire a teacher. And you translate that same argument over to the federal government, and there is this sense that we need to do something to make our employees more accountable. And so I've And you're going to hear more about that. Once we get past all the pay stuff that's going on now and how many federal employee benefits might or might not be cut in the coming months as Congress deals with the CR and next year's budget and the debt ceiling extension and all of those things, we could see extension of the pay freeze. We could see a change in the way the retirement is calculated. But once we get beyond that, then I think you're going to see more specific emphasis on this accountability issue.
You've represented both sides of, I won't say the aisle, or the manager as well as the staff member. Have you ever had a staff member that just kind of keeps to themselves, does a good job, maybe a very good job, and then is saying, boy, somebody recognizes you're really good, you should be a manager. And the person says, I don't want to be a manager. I just love what I'm doing, and I don't want the responsibility. I don't want the headaches. I don't want the potential conflict issues. Have you ever had anybody like that come
sure.
to you?
And there are people that are wise enough to recognize their own shortcomings. And sometimes you have very talented people who would be excellent managers. Who simply don't want the hassle, the uncertainty. They like what they do, and they therefore will sit back. And there are actually some mechanisms in the federal employee system to account for that. There is, for example, if you are a very, very good lawyer and you want to just do trial work, you're at the Department of Justice, you can be promoted from the GS-15 into what's called an SL position. Which means that you're going to be paid the same as a senior executive, but you're not going to have any managerial responsibilities, and your expertise would be recognized. There are also ST positions for technical and engineers and scientists, and there are some ST positions in the federal government where the employees are world-renowned scientists who have won the Nobel Prize, and they're paid, again, at the senior executive level. Unfortunately, I think that very often the SL and ST system isn't utilized as much as it could be. There are actually only 1,000 of these positions in both the SL and ST government wide. It's a small amount. So you know, you're not. It is a small answer to the problem. It's like we're going to deal with the fact that not every real good technician's going to be a manager or wants to be a manager. We're gonna deal with it in a very small way. We're not going to really address the problem. And I have to give John Barry at OPM, director of OPM, credit because he recognizes this. And he, when he first became the director of OPM, made some very, very serious efforts to try to change the system to allow for more of this recognition of the technical ability. And to kind of end this notion that, you know, once you get to be a good technician, the only way to make more money is to make you a manager, which is pretty much the way it is in most of the government.
So let me reverse the table here. I'm a staff member now, or an individual's a staff member, does a really good job. But they do a good job because they want to do a good job, but they also want that management position. They want to make more money. But they get passed over for whatever reason. What advice would you give that person? Maybe they rub the management the wrong way. Maybe they don't. Maybe they're just, they sit in a corner and do the work and the manager doesn't like them. What can they do to keep their proverbial skirts clean so that they could have a challenge that would be successful?
When you say a challenge that could be successful.
Why didn't I get the job? I did everything you asked me to do in record time. I'm better than the rest of the people in the office.
And why didn't I get promoted?
And I get passed over. What did I do wrong if I did anything wrong? Maybe, you know, there's only so many manager positions. I understand that. But
there are only a couple of ways that an employee can challenge a non-selection for promotion. One of them is the EO system. If you're a non-selected and you look at the field of candidates and you see that someone was selected who happens to be a different race, gender, national origin, religion, who maybe you have a disability, they don't. You've filed other EEO complaints in the past over other injustices that you've perceived. They have not. If you can point out some difference between you and the selectee, then you have a prima facie EEO case. You can file an EEO complaint. The agency would investigate it, and excuse me, the issue would be, is there a good reason for this person not being selected? Was the other person more qualified? Is that the reason the other person was selected? Was the employee who's complaining, were they really much more qualified? And maybe one of these illegal reasons affected the decision of the selecting official. That's what the EEO system is all about. A lot of EEO cases concern the non-selection for promotion. And you have a kind of a difficult environment where the employee, who's non-selected, will file an EEO complaint and continue to come to work every day, work in the same office where the selectee is now the complaining employee's supervisor. The higher level, the second or third level supervisor was the selecting official for that position. And it creates an unhealthy dynamic or potentially unhealthy dynamic. I think the very smart and successful person who files a complaint like that, who uses the EEO system, files their complaint in EEO, leaves it there, and then comes to work every day and does his or her job to the best of their ability, being as responsive as they can be to this person that, deep down they feel some resentment toward because they feel like they got a job that should have been that employee's. That's one way. The other way to challenge it is by claiming that you're a whistleblower, that you have, you're not selected because you insist on following the law. And when the law is not followed, you tell somebody that the law hasn't been followed. Or if you think money is being wasted, you tell somebody that money is being wasted. And therefore, higher level management says, well, why would I want to hire that person? Why would I want to promote them and allow them to do even more damage? Well, that can be whistleblower reprisal, and that is illegal. And there's a process for determining whether there is retaliation. There's an Office of Special Counsel that investigates these things if an employee files a complaint. And managers who retaliate against whistleblowers are violating the law and can be held accountable, and sometimes are.
Have you found, let's say, that individual prevails in their grievance? And are they looked upon? I'm sure they're looked upon for a while. Like, they want that. I don't know if I want to deal with that person. So what obstacles do they, once they do prevail, they don't want to carry that stigma with them. What should they watch out for?
You're talking about an employee who's filed an EEO complaint. And they've been successful.
Yes.
They've gotten promoted.
Mm-hmm.
And they come in with this little slight stigma of,
yep,
the only reason they got this is because they filed a complaint or mm-hmm. because they belong to a particular ethnic
exactly.
group. And otherwise, they would have never gotten mm-hmm. promoted. There is some of that. There's no question. But, the EEO system, by and large, is covered by the Privacy Act unless you go to federal court. And so a lot of it is kept quiet, hush-hush. A lot of settlement agreements occur where an employee might be given a chance for either priority consideration for a future selection, and they might be selected for it, or they might even be promoted, and it's kept. There's a confidentiality clause so that people don't know. And so you're really the only thing that kind of goes on is the rumor mill. But what I've seen people do occasionally, somebody who really doesn't deserve the promotion and gets it and comes in and does a very poor job as a manager. And then that kind of feeds that speculation. Oh, the only reason they got it is because they filed a complaint or because of their race or because of their gender or whatever the reason is. When they do a poor job, it just, other people say, oh, it must have been. And so there's the rumor mill and the gossiping that occurs in the federal employee workplace sometimes that's encouraged by that. I think most people who are truly discriminated against, who really didn't get a promotion to a high level position, because of their gender in glass ceiling cases, and they end up receiving a promotion like that. Most of those cases, the employee shines. They really do quite a good job when they take over the higher level position. And when they do that, people forget. If they ever knew that somebody filed an EEO complaint, they quickly forget it.
What was your toughest representation in that regard with the employee, where they really were good, but they didn't prevail, or was most surprising, if you will, verdict rendered to you? And what would you do to...
You know, Bob, I can't talk about...
I know you can't talk about specifics.
Specific cases, but I have had several, particularly women, who were at very high levels, who simply couldn't quite break into the senior executive service, particularly in scientific and technical fields. They were male dominated, and I have several. I'm like three or four where we were successful, either as a result of an adjudication by a judge or a settlement agreement when it became very clear that this person was being treated unfairly, who have gone into the senior executive service and have done quite well as a result. And so those are cases where I feel real good that, in fact, the system worked. I mean, it's kind of like you need the system because there is that injustice. On the other hand, when the EEOC issues its annual report, it says that only 3% of EEO complaints result in findings of discrimination. Another 20% are settled, which leaves about 75% or so of the EO complaints either being thrown out because they aren't covered by the law or being found not to actually prove discrimination. So that's a lot
that's
of...
That's a huge percent.
It's a large percent. And the other problem with the EO system is that it takes a long time. It takes years to finish the process. And so the manager has this EO complaint hanging over his or her head. And the negative stigma that goes along with that by the EEO office, the higher level manager, and particularly if you get multiple EEO complaints, then you get a reputation for, among your subordinates, or not your subordinates so much, because they don't necessarily know this unless the employees are going all around talking about the EEO complaints they filed. But they get a reputation as perhaps somebody who could be a better manager. And sometimes it's very unfair, particularly if employees sense that, hey, the more complaints I file against my manager, the more I can control my manager and keep them from acting against me to prevent if they act against me, I'll file a retaliation complaint. So it's an interesting dynamic, and it's one that I think could be helped, maybe not fixed completely, could be helped by making the manager a little bit more of the EO process. Right now, employee goes and files a complaint. They do it with impunity. There's no penalty if the employee's complaint is found to be frivolous. There's no filing fee that they forfeit. You just go in and you just go to the EO office and you start the process. So if a manager is dealing with this, they then might, initially they have an informal contact with an EEO counselor, and then 6 months, 2 years later, be asked to produce a statement about why they treated the employee the way they did, why they made the non-selection, why did you give them the unsatisfactory performance rating. And then a year after that, it might come to a hearing with an EEOC judge, or it might go to a hearing in federal district court. And all of this time, the manager is dealing with this complaint. And eventually, if it's found to be not frivolous, or it's found to be frivolous, the manager might have some bad things happen to him or her along the way, and there's no like going back and looking at it, were you treated fairly? And the manager doesn't necessarily have the right to an attorney as they go through that process. They don't necessarily have the right to see everything the employee says about the manager, not necessarily. Sometimes some agencies do. So I think by changing that and making the manager a little bit more of the process and giving them some rights in the process, the rights to see everything filed against them, the right to an attorney, the right to go back and fix things that may have happened because the complaint existed, will encourage more managers to deal with problem employees, knowing that they will have a fair EEO process, a fair EEO process to them as well as to the employee who's accusing the manager of discriminating.
Wow.
So it's you've got these cases where, people have been discriminated against, and then you've got managers who are dealing with employees who file frivolous complaints. And where do you draw the line? And I think, one of the things you do is you make the process work a bit faster. you take it, you know, maybe take it out of the agency. Right now, the agency investigates itself for a couple of years, sort of plays with it and you know, creates a little investigative report. And then you go to the EOC. If you take it out of the agency or up front and you put it in front of some people who know what they're doing, you would be able to take half the EO cases that are filed and get rid of them early on and then deal with the other complaints that have some substance and merit and figure out who's being discriminated against. Because it's no good for the victim either. If somebody's been a victim of discrimination and they have to wait 2, 3, 4 years for justice, that's a problem for them, as well as the manager who's has the frivolous complaint hanging over his or her head. Obviously not the same case. They're different cases. But it doesn't work for either the employee or the manager.
All right, let me switch gears a little bit. We have a fan of the show on the West Coast, and I know he would want me to ask this question, although he didn't email me. Union. So I'm a manager now. I'm put in, and my staff are union members. Do I have more of a wall in front of me than I do if they're not union members?
Well, you, as a manager, have to respect the union. You have to recognize that they are a legal entity that is the exclusive representative of your bargaining unit employees that you supervise. And you can't try to ignore them, go around them. You should, as a manager, be familiar with the collective bargaining agreement. You should read it. And you should read it several times during the year so that you're familiar with it, so that you understand what your obligations are. For example, most collective bargaining agreements will have rules on when an employee who's having trouble getting to work, will call in sick at the last minute. They'll have a process by which you can put the employee on a leave restriction letter. And if you don't know that process and you mess up, the union's going to file a grievance and you're going to feel like, oh my gosh, the union's got me every time I turn around. They're blocking my managerial discretion, when in fact the manager just simply hasn't been aware of the collective bargaining agreement and the process that they need to be familiar with to follow. The other thing managers have to recognize is they have a great deal of discretion and authority in running the workplace. But when they want to implement a new process, a new procedure, when they want to change something, they have to notify the union about it. They have to give the union a chance to weigh in. It's called impact and implementation bargaining. And today, with President Obama, there's a tremendous additional emphasis on having a good working relationship with the union. And as you're thinking about, as a manager is thinking about changing something in the workplace, implementing a new policy, and they haven't made a decision to do it, you tell the union what you're thinking about. It's called pre-decisional involvement. And you get their input early on, and then you make the decision, and then you tell the union, and then you have to give them a chance to collectively bargain. And it's frustrating for some managers because they've involved the union, done everything they've said, and then the union wants a little bit more. At least that's how a manager perceives it. But it is the right of the union, and I think you have to recognize this and you have to respect it. And by being familiar with the collective bargaining agreement and by managers getting trained, I think they can be effective even in a unionized workforce. But if you simply view the union as an impediment, then the manager will say, well, I can't deal with them because they're in the union, therefore I won't do anything. And that's exactly the wrong thing to do. And you're opening managers who do that are opening themselves up to comments like Colleen Kelly made last week when she testified at the pay parity hearing in the House of Representatives, that part of the problem is managers not doing their job. And when managers don't act, when they don't follow the rules, when they don't respect the union, when they don't take action against problem employees when they should, there's some validity to that.
This is maybe too global, but let's say I am a union member. Is it easier for me to file a grievance because I can go two ways now, through the union, or can I go skip the union and go through the civil?
It depends on your collective bargaining agreement. If you have a union, any workplace grievance, anything you don't like about what's going on at work, including disciplinary action, you don't like the way your supervisor looks at you, is subject to filing a grievance. That grievance, by law, that grievance can go up to arbitration, and it can come, go outside the agency to an arbitrator who can impose on the agency a decision that would require the agency to do something it doesn't want to do. Now, when the union does that, when they invoke arbitration, guess what? They have to pay for it. Not 100%. The agency and the union split the cost. So the union's not going to take every grievance to arbitration. And there's a process within the agency by which different layers of management will consider the grievance. And then there's EEO, and some collective bargaining agreements will have the union involvement with EEO or allow you to raise an EEO issue as part of a grievance, and it depends upon the wording of the collective bargaining agreement. But typically, a grievance would be covered by the collective bargaining, EEO, either the collective bargaining or the EEO system, employee's choice. And then there's the Merit Systems Protection Board, which is an independent agency where employees who are subject to severe discipline, 15-day suspensions or more, demotions or removals, can take it there, or they can take it to arbitration. And it's the union's choice whether which of those forums it would use for the employee.
All righty, with these federal employee accountability rules, and let's now go back to the manager's side. They need, I would guess, to be very clear in their understanding of what the rules are so that they can pass it along to the staff and say, listen, this is what we have to do. And they could almost say, it wasn't me, this came out of Congress, but we're all in it together. Let's make sure we understand it. Do you find people are hesitant to do that? Some managers shouldn't be managers. Some staff shouldn't be staff. They should be managers.
Some staff think they should be managers. No question about that. But the I find that when you have a clear idea as a manager what your mission is, and that mission sometimes is determined by Congress, as interpreted by the political leadership and communicated down through various layers of management to get to the frontline supervisor. I find that having that clear focus on mission helps everything else fall into place. An agency has the authority to take action against an employee for reasons that promote the efficiency of the service, which relates to mission. You can take action against a poor performer if they're not meeting their performance standards, which again relates to mission. And I think focusing on mission rather than personalities or favoritism, things like that, helps a manager succeed.
There are we are, of course, a seminar company focused on pre-retirement, but we go all the way from beginning all the way through and beyond retirement. But I am reasonably certain that there are vendors that provide courses on EEOC, on management responsibilities, on understanding the dynamics of working with staff. I'm sure the SEA provides those.
Oh, they do.
I'm sure they do.
We have an annual conference, June 16th.
And where might that be?
SeniorExecs.org. You can go there and find out all about it. And there is going to be a focus this year dealing with the efforts to continue to operate the government in very challenging times.
And I was unfair because I didn't ask you your website or phone number.
Yeah, it's Shaw Bransford, SHAWBRANSFORD.com. Our telephone number is 202-463-8400. And our law firm does specialize in representing federal employees, and in particular, I think, managers and law enforcement.
Yeah, and you're good.
We try.
No,
we try.
You're good. We've known each other a long time. And
thank you. Appreciate that, Bob.
I guess as we come down, we're not quite there. We've got about 9 minutes left. But we talked a little bit in the proverbial green room before the show started about pay disparity. There's this conception, misconception, or accurate, whatever, that the feds are overpaid. Do you get involved with that? I mean, you don't have to try your case in front of private industry, but...
Well, I do. You know, I'm general... One of the things I do, I'm general counsel of the Senior Executives Association. And obviously, whether or not senior executives are adequately compensated for what they do is a major concern we have. And everyone I talk to says that the belief is that senior executives are underpaid, if anything. Even the Heritage Foundation agrees with that premise. excuse me. The problem here, Bob, is that USA Today publishes periodically news articles that say that federal employees are paid more than their private sector counterparts for doing the same work. And they point to Bureau of Labor statistics that say, well, a private sector person, a plumber, makes X dollars, and in the federal government, they make a different amount. And the difficulty is you can't really compare what federal employees do in these federal employee jobs to what the private sector employees do, because the federal employee person very often needs to be more qualified, has a higher scope of responsibility, and there's never been a fair, complete, and accurate job-to-job analysis. So we really don't know. The bottom line is we really don't know. But I will tell you, the Senior Executives Association has studied executive compensation. We've had outside vendors take a look at it, and every study we've done indicates that executives are, in fact, underpaid. Federal employees, senior executives are underpaid. The President of the United States, a couple of months ago, said that he believes that lower-graded federal employees are overpaid, but higher level, particularly those who have high technical abilities, and those in the supervisory and executive ranks are underpaid. And so there was a hearing last week in the House of Representatives in which a lot of rhetoric occurred about the fact that federal employees are overpaid, and we need to do something about that. And yet we really don't know.
That's very hard to do. The IRS they look at a company and they'll call it excess compensation. They'll look at somebody that owns a company or runs a company, small, medium, large. And they say, you make too much, you can't write this off.
And I guarantee you that all of those people that make too much, you can't write it off, that what they can write off is more than what any federal employee earns.
That's what I'm saying. So the idea that the SES level is maybe underpaid, how do you ever come up to what the market value is of that service? There's only one way. It's when they leave and they get hired at two or three times what they were making, or one and a half times, whatever the number is. And that's pretty much proof positive, but you can't have people leaving just to prove a point.
That's true, because, there's a lot of people that do tremendous work for the nation's taxpayers, and particularly at the higher levels. There's only 7,000 senior executives out of 2 million federal employees. That's a small percentage. And you think that for, 98% of these people, if not more, got their jobs in the senior executive service because they were good and they deserved it. OPM, as it goes through a vetting process, they make sure that people, in fact, have executive core qualifications before they're allowed to come into the career senior executive service. And when you bring them in and you don't compensate them, you encourage them to leave. If they have a job opportunity on the outside, then you try to bring up somebody else. And of course, what we found at the Senior Executives Association is that with the pay compression that exists, SES pay has been kept down, GS-15 pay went up. And it's kind of like, well, why bother leaving the GS-15 job where you get alternative work schedules every other Friday off, you can telework, you can do all these other things, and you don't, life is easier, and the difference in pay isn't great enough, or the potential difference in pay isn't great enough to even encourage somebody to apply. It's a problem. It's a problem for future leadership.
I don't work with SESers certainly near as much as you do, but the ones I do work with, I find somewhat of a pattern. They do their job for the love of the country, and they know they can make more. And they say, my job's important, and I know I can make more somewhere else, but I feel the greater good. I know this sounds schmaltzy, but the greater good. And I'm kind of always impressed with that.
But it's true. And there's still people, thank God for the country, that despite the problem in the pay system, believe that and apply, really good people apply to the SES. But the problem is it's not happening as much as it used to. Mm. Because of the difference in pay. And we're looking at, in fact, it's going to be a hearing toward the end of this month in the Senate on the SES that the Senior Executives Association will be testifying at. So since it's not happening as much, what can be done to help the SES? And it's tough right now because there's a pay freeze. senior executives aren't getting any increase unless they get a new job with increased responsibilities. They can do that, but there's such a negative impression out there in agency management about not giving pay raises. It's going to be tough. So what's the long-term effect of that? You know, we're just getting started with this pay freeze. And how many GS-14s and 15s are really going to care about coming into the SES during this time of
And that's heightened by the proverbial brain drain, because you've got the baby boomers that probably are a fairly good percent of the SES corps.
It's a problem. And because no congressman or senator wants to now go out there and be on record as increased spending, you know, it just adds to the complexity.
All right. We've got a little bit more than 2 minutes to go, so let's just change chairs a little bit. Let's talk to the manager and say, okay, under this federal accountability rules, what should they do so that nobody could attack them for not doing their homework?
Well, the first thing you have to recognize is that no matter how good of a job you do, no matter how perfect of a manager you've been, no matter how much you've been trained, chances are in anybody's federal career as a manager, they're going to get an EEO complaint or a grievance filed against them. That's just simply the nature of the beast. And recognizing that, number one, and not taking it personally, responding to the system, keeping the documentation, dealing with situations as they come up are, I think, the best way to respond. Just because a manager gets an EEO complaint filed against them does not mean they're a bad manager, although a lot of employees would like that to be the case.
And as you mentioned at the top of the show, this might sometimes be done on their own time because there's a lack of funds to train the manager.
There is a lack of congressional will to mandate that agencies spend money. There are agencies that think managerial training is important, and there are other agencies that say, oh my gosh, we have to cut our budget. The first thing we're going to cut is training and travel. So there is not a consistency now among agencies. So we're heading toward possibly a government shutdown, everyone says. I'm not exactly sure when that will occur or whether we'll be able to work out some compromise that prevents it.
Okay.
But
in 20 seconds, that
may be the future.
Let's change chairs. 20 seconds. I'm the employee now. How do I keep my self up to date?
Well, as the employee, you want to be careful and make sure you got your stuff together. Make sure you tell the truth as you go through these and use the system. Use your rights that you have.
Great advice. Thanks, Bill. Bill Bransford, Shaw Bransford, and you've got the phone number and the website. Thanks for listening. What's your phone number again?
Good to be here. 202-463-8400. Thanks for having me on the show, Bob.
It's great to see you. See you Saturday night.
Thank you. Looking forward to it.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.
For 11 years, government leaders have gathered to explore the latest mandates and best practices at the Government Performance Summit. Today, with a major revision to the Government Performance and Results Act, there is an unparalleled opportunity to integrate analytics into better decision-making for the entire nation. Join hosts the Performance Institute, FMA, AGA, and GovEvents, April 4th through the 6th for the 11th Annual Government Performance Summit. Space is limited, so register today.